listening to Popaganda, a bitch radio podcast from Bitch Media, a feminist response to pop culture. This episode was recorded on Thursday, May 5th at the Bitch headquarters in Portland, Oregon. Warning, the following podcast contains explicit language, including the word bitch, of course. Hello, welcome back to another episode of Bitch Popaganda. I'm Kelsey Wallace, the web editor here at Bitch, and with me today are...
Sherston Johnson, the web content manager.
And Andy Zeisler, editorial / creative director.
And today we're going to talk about Donald Trump's sexism, aspirational television, and a summer movie preview. So let's get started. Anna Holmes wrote a column for the Washington Post this week called Donald Trump's Sexism. And it's basically, well, Sherston, why don't you tell us what it's about?
Well, I think everyone's been hearing a lot about Donald Trump recently because he's been like really just pushing, he pushed the whole birth certificate thing back into the spotlight, even though no one wanted to see it there except for the Tea Party, I think. He's going to run for president, I guess. But Anna Holmes did everyone the favor of reminding them what a douchebag he's been for like decades now.
Yeah, it was basically like a reminder of everything that's odious about Donald Trump is nothing new. He's really been perfecting his brand of douchebaggery for, you know, three decades at least at this point. And much of it really revolves around his quite low and quite public low opinion of women and girls.
So do you think, I feel like this article assumes that a lot of people just in kind of the public at large either, you know, have forgotten about some of this or just kind of don't care about it or are at least sort of taking it for granted. Just like, yeah, Donald Trump is a sexist douche. Yet, you know, I don't think people are taking his presidential run too seriously, but his poll numbers aren't bad. I mean, he's looking better than some of the other Republican candidates. And so do you think there's something about him or is it something about our cultural climate that is just, you know, that we're just accepting this? Like, yeah, you know, he makes the Miss USA pageant contestants parade in front of him in their underwear, but that's just Trump being Trump, you know? I don't know, what do you think it is that some people are just swallowing this from him?
I think culturally we've gotten to a point, or we get to a point with certain public figures where we have it in our heads that it's not worth criticizing them because they are who they are and they're these outsized characters, you know?
Like you don't want to take someone with that haircut seriously.
Exactly. Or like Jack Nicholson. Like we all know Jack Nicholson is going to show up at the Knicks game and be mugging for the camera and have like an 18-year-old next to him. Like he's just wacky Jack. And, you know, we've done it. We do it with a lot of people. I think that was really on display with a lot of the Charlie Sheen stuff. It's sort of like their boorishness or their douchebagness or their sexism or whatever is just kind of in itself, it's become entertainment, and we don't take it seriously. So when someone like Donald Trump is actually in a position of possibly being, and I don't believe that he is a contender, but he's in a position of possibly being taken seriously, I do think like these reminders are helpful. Although frankly, the people who would take these reminders seriously aren't the people who consider him a contender, I guess.
Right, exactly. Somebody who's thinking that he seems like a pretty good presidential candidate probably did not have his or her mind changed by reading this column.
I mean, yeah, and then it's funny because, I mean, in the article she quotes Carrie Prejean, who has come out, like, totally in opposition to gay marriage, and Carrie Prejean has, like, pointed out what a douchebag Donald Trump is, so, like, hopefully that'll change someone's mind.
Maybe somebody will see, like, oh, I'm with Preji.
Yes.
If she thinks he's a douche.
It's really a race to the bottom with those two.
Yeah. The thing that really struck me, because I think I'm guilty of writing off Donald Trump as just a complete joke and not thinking that seriously about his just like blatant sexism and creepiness. There's a quote in here where he talks about his eldest daughter, Ivanka, and once he said, she does have a very nice figure. If she weren't my daughter, perhaps I'd be dating her.
And what I want to know is, what was the question that preceded that right, just statement? Like, did someone say, like, would you ever date your daughter?
Do you think your daughter is a hot piece? Or, it's just, you know, I feel like that, to me, the fact that someone who said that about his own daughter in a public way is even being taken seriously by anyone to run for office just tells me that some people get a pass on stuff like this and some people don't. I mean, I think, you know, I was Googling Sarah Palin to see how old her eldest son is to draw a comparison. He's pretty young, but still, if Sarah Palin said that, you know, that she thought that track was like really hot and that maybe if he weren't her son, she would date him, I don't think that, that she'd get very far in a political race. That's really gross.
Well, I mean,
that's pretty out there. That's beyond objectifying Miss USA contestants and into a completely new realm.
Well, sure, especially because people, again, it's one of those things where people are like, well, she's in the Miss USA pageant. She's got to be used to about being evaluated like a piece of meat. But yeah, it's sort of like, you know, I think Donald Trump has made a lot of these kind of like really kind of beyond the pale and beyond what most people would consider just sort of regular everyday tastelessness or sexism. Like, he's made a lot of comments like that, and I do think it's useful to keep bringing them up.
So is the lesson here for people who are thinking about in 3 or 4 decades running for political office that if you kick it off now with a really high level of misogyny and just sort of overall offensive behavior, that everyone's tolerance, like, you're just building up a public tolerance for it to the point where if you launch a presidential campaign, everyone will be like, well, that's just her being her, you know, she's an asshole.
So. Yeah.
I think because we've been conditioned.
It with so many people, like, yeah. Deb Charney, it's just like that good old Dove, like, keep being sleazy. Like.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the danger, I mean, I you know, I really don't know that this has anything to do with the presidential campaign because, I'm of the group that believes that this whole presidential campaign of Donald Trump's is a sham, just meant to promote his celebrity apprentice ratings.
Let's hope so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think the more important lesson here is like, why, just because something persists over time, do we need to give it a pass? Like, do we need to believe that, like, just because, you know, Donald Trump or Dove Charney.
Or I think Arnold Schwarzenegger, who is the governor, or did win the governor's race in California,
exactly.
And has a long history of sexual harassment. And, you know, we're just kind of willing to swallow it because he's been in the public eye for so long. That,
or because, you know, it's funny because he's Arnold Schwarzenegger. So,
right.
Again, he gets the pass because it's entertainment.
I mean, I think there's a larger issue here about, you know, politicians and the kind of ego that leads one to go into politics because, you know, Bill Clinton had a long history of sexual harassment, which didn't, you know, for me, and admittedly I'm a Democrat, didn't really mitigate or affect his politics. But I think when it's someone who is a personality first, or like a, you know, a celebrity financier or a bodybuilding, you know, movie star, it's a little different. And it's hard to sort of tease out what makes it different. And I know there are a lot of people on the right who are like, well, nobody's talking about how Bill Clinton had this long history of sexual harassment and, you know, mistreatment. It's very possible that we just have to take for granted that anyone who gets into politics has a sense of their own righteousness that impacts how they treat other people in general, not just women. But, you know, I don't think that means we shouldn't point out the most egregious examples, especially when, as in Donald Trump's case, it really doesn't seem to have much to do with actual political aspirations.
Right, and then, you know, yet also in Donald Trump's case, some of his misogyny does seem to be bleeding into the politics that he's, at least, I mean, I do think that he's kind of a fake and a sham, and so I think some of the stances he's taking are more for attention. I mean, I don't know if I don't buy that he even thinks that the birth certificate is a fake. I mean, I think it's just like he's kind of capitalizing on an opportunity to get attention, but, you know, he's changed his position on women's reproductive rights. And then I believe it was his aide who said, well, yeah, you know, he changes, like, you change your mind just like you change wives, you know, it's just how it goes. And it's like, well, both of those attitudes are actually kind of problematic.
Basically what he's saying is if you're someone who changes wives like they change their socks, you're probably a douchebag who's going to flip-flop.
Right, and it's like, we shouldn't believe what you said about being pro-choice 5 years ago because, well, you had a different wife then too, you know, so. So yeah, I mean, I think we can safely say none of us are planning on voting for him. But it's except for Shakespeare. But I really appreciated Anna Holmes' article just because I do think, you know, kind of like what Andy was saying, it's important that we keep being reminded of this stuff. And on that note, okay, well, speaking of things that, you know, are taken seriously or not, there was an article in the New York Times this week by Dan Coyes, I think I'm saying that right, called Eating Your Cultural Vegetables, which was about what Dan is calling sort of aspirational television and film watching. And to define that, a quote from the article: "These are the kinds of films and television dearly loved by the writers, thinkers, and friends I most respect, so I too seek them out. I usually doze lightly through them, and I often feel moved, if sleepy, afterward. But am I actually moved, or am I responding to the rhythms of emotionally affecting cinema? Am I laughing because I get the jokes, or because I know what jokes sound like?" So it's basically an article about the stuff that we watch because we feel like we should, or because we want to be involved in a cultural conversation about it, but if we're honest with ourselves, we actually don't care that much. So Andy, what did you think of the article? Did you kind of identify with Dan here?
Yeah, I mean, it really resonated with me, especially now that I feel like television has really gotten so much smarter and is, you know, very much, for me at least, kind of the center of my personal media diet, I think more so than films and probably more so than like visual art and maybe even music, just because it is something that I do pretty much every day for at least an hour. And it just reminded me of all the things that even as I'm saying them, kind of empty promises I make to myself about things that I'm going to put on my Netflix queue. I'm going to get around to watching all however many seasons of Lost there were. See, I don't even know. Just so I can finally get the smoke monster references that are still, like,
percolating. I gave up on Lost also. Yeah.
So I think, the piece definitely resonated with me in that way.
Kirsten, what about you?
Yeah, I feel like I went through my phase of trying to catch up on all, you know, the what's what of film with a capital F, and have just saw too many films where I was like, I've had it, like, I know this is, like, really revolutionary in film history, but, like, I can't watch another, like, avant-garde silent thing, which sort of, like, quelled my thirst to, like, keep up with, you know, the Joneses or whatever as far as media. So now I think I definitely take recommendations, but because television has become so, you know, there are these hour-long shows that have six seasons apiece. Like, I am worried about starting something. I would like to get the whole thing instead of just starting something, and I just don't have the time to watch everything, and so I try and pick what I watch specifically and try not to watch everything that I think I should watch.
Now, do you pick things based on the conversations that you can have with other people about them? Like, do you choose to watch things because you want to be involved in the discourse? Or is it really just about kind of what you yourself are drawn to as a viewer?
I would say what I'm drawn to as a viewer, but also about accessibility. Like, if I don't have a television, I didn't have internet at my home for a while, so it was sort of like, how much do I want to spend at the video store? That my friends can, like, give me a download file for this. So I did have to, like, now that I have Netflix Instant, it changes things. But, you know, it was a lot about accessibility and how much time and money I could bring to it.
I have to say that I chalk it up to working here at Bitch. And while I work at a media organization, so I have to keep up with this stuff, but I know a lot of it is just, like, straight up peer pressure. Like, I feel a lot of pressure to keep up with shows. I got cable and HBO partially because of that, even though I justified it in other ways. And, like, but part of it is because I really like watching TV too. But, you know, I was kind of combing through my roster of shows thinking, okay, what here am I just keeping up with because I want to be involved in the conversation? Or, to me, the more telling was, what series did I watch a few episodes of, and then now I lie and say that I've, like, am keeping up with it, but I'm really not.
So you're not
going to
tell us?
No, I am. So a few shows that I pretend
by
to...
By the way, Kelsey just opened up a notebook slowly.
There's at least a page.
A few shows that I pretend to care about, but I really don't, are, first of all, I'll cop to Saturday Night Live. I don't like it. I never really have. But
that's one for me where it's just like the time investment isn't worth the payback. I need to like a specific sketch to watch.
I'll watch a sketch like on YouTube, but I kind of cop to caring about Saturday Night Live more than I actually do because I know that it's culturally significant and like I read Bossy Pants. I see people from SNL, all of Seth Meyers at the Correspondents' Dinner. It's like, oh, Saturday Night Live. It's part of our sort of cultural conversation, but I don't like it, and I'll actually kind of go so far as to say that I have faked liking other sketch comedy shows, too, that I really don't. Portlandia.
Yeah, Portlandia's on my list,
too. I only watched the first three episodes, but I have pretended to have seen more than that.
It's very easy to do with Portlandia.
We are in Portland right now.
You can be like, remember that sketch where they disling Goofy? But I have to admit, I was really outraged when I heard that it had been renewed for a second season. I was like, why?
Yeah.
And then I realized admitting this is like a huge faux pas.
Here we are in Portland.
Someone's going to throw like a thing of poutine at me.
Yeah. We're like
from a moving car.
I just got that from Portlandia.
I did.
We're at a feminist magazine, which is something that's like kind of ripe for Portlandia fodder. But yeah, I watched a few episodes and now I think we've all experienced like friends outside of Portland being like, mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, did you
my
see
mom,
that thing?
Like,
yeah.
Ultimately, like the ultimate, like this has gone too far.
Right.
I saw it.
No, I couldn't take it anymore. There were a few jokes that I liked, but not really. Also, The Walking Dead on AMC. I made it through an episode and a half. That guy's fake Southern accent. I couldn't take it. But I was like, yeah, The Walking Dead, this is an important show. Zombies, we're moving forward, you know. And then also pretty much anything animated. Turns out I don't have the right brain for it. But I'm like, oh.
I've been faking like knowledge of The Simpsons.
Me too, The Simpsons.
Probably as long as it's been on the air.
South Park, Aqua Teen Hunger Force, Archer, Futurama, like anything except King of the Hill, which I do genuinely like and will watch a full episode. I just sort of, you know, just kind of fall back on my knowledge of the show existing.
I think what's interesting is that, you know, because this article was called Eating Your Cultural Vegetables or Cultural Veggies or something, and I feel like, you know, for a lot of people, those are like actually the opposite. They're like the equivalent of like the cultural Twinkie. So, and you probably watch a lot of headier, you know, like you watched all of The Wire, which for a lot of people would be their cultural vegetable. So I think it also depends on where you're coming from.
I think it depends on where you're coming from and how much you care about being able to talk about TV, which for me is a lot. I think I care a lot more than the average person about being able to have a conversation with someone about a TV show. And I put a high premium on keeping up with stuff to the detriment of other stuff. I mean, I was embarrassed, like, looking at the AV Club top 25 programs of the past decade, that I've given them all a shot, all 25. Just like, what didn't I read because of this? You know, how many times have I sat through, like, Arrested Development when I could have been, like, reading a novel that would have a life-changing impact on me? But I haven't, you know?
Yeah, what this article made me realize is that the way I often, like, impose these sort of cultural vegetable things on other people, like Julie, our executive director,
I absolutely
shamed her into watching Dexter, which now she's really into. But then, when I found out that she hadn't seen the lead character, whose name I'm now forgetting,
Michael C. Hall
in 6 Feet Under, I was like, what do you mean you haven't seen 6 Feet Under? And I was like a real bully about it.
Yeah.
So I feel like I certainly, this article sort of made me recognize that part of myself that's really, can be super pushy about this stuff.
I can be super pushy about it. I also kind of related to, she talks about seeing Kelly Reichardt's film Meek's Cutoff, and being sort of bored during it and realizing that she was kind of, he was seeing it for kind of maybe some of the wrong reasons. I had a similar experience with Meek's Cutoff over the weekend, except I had a plan to go and see it with my boyfriend, and about 15 minutes before we were going to leave for the movie, I was like, I've got to be honest, I actually don't want to see this movie. And he also admitted to not wanting to see it, but we were both pretending like we did want to see it because we listened to this Fresh Air interview with Kelly Reichardt and was like, man, that sounds awesome, and I'm really into the Oregon Trail, I love Michelle Williams, let's do this. And then it's like it was nice weather, and
did you go see Fast Five instead?
I think we just went home and just like, we probably like watched Downton Abbey in Netflix instant and just like petted the dog and was just like, I'm kind of glad that I'm not at Meek's Cutoff right now. So, although I'll say, this is exactly what the author was getting at. Like, I'm still going to tell people that I want to see Meek's Cutoff, and I probably will see it, too. You know? Because it's about the Oregon Trail. How could I not?
That's true.
But
you might have a geographical imperative to see that movie.
But also, it's like, oh, it's a woman director, and she's critically acclaimed, and, like, I have to. To me, that's a total cultural vegetable. Mm-hmm. I'm going to choke it down, you know? Although I also like vegetables, so I don't know. Does anyone else want to own up to a show that you kind of pretend to be plugged into but you actually hate?
Oh, I feel like I definitely have an answer.
Or that you gave up on, like that you were kind of...
I feel like I really gave Tremé a shot. You know, I love music. I love a lot of the actors on it. It was so fragmented to me, and I really felt the cultural weight of expectation. That I was really supposed to like it and find it deep and meaningful. And I just didn't, you know? And I feel like deeply shamed about that sometimes. But then most of the time I'm like, well, I'm just gonna, you know, I'm gonna watch Nurse Jackie instead.
When Glee first started, I watched it, and I mean, feminist critiques of Glee aside, I had to stop watching it because I was so bored, and I hated all the characters. I hated Mr. Schuster, and I could not stand his face and anything that he said. So I just had to stop watching that because as like au courant as it would have been for bitch media to keep watching it, I just like couldn't handle it. And Lost, I started watching Lost simply to have my cultural vegetable protein about anything about Lost, and I weaned myself off of it in the second season, so.
I quit watching Glee and Lost also, and you quit watching Lost too. I never started.
But I will say this though, sometimes something you think is gonna be a cultural vegetable is totally like a cultural Twinkie instead. Like I really thought Game of Thrones was gonna be super heavy, and I sort of put off watching it, and I was like, this might be a show that I have to fake my way through, and now I'm obsessed with it to the point where I'm probably gonna start reading the books as well.
And it's complete soap opera and it's drama.
Yeah, and it is like, it is, I don't know, whatever the medieval version of a Twinkie is. It's that.
Yeah, I'm trying to, they drink a lot
it's
of wine.
It's so healthy. I do think that they're, you know, again, for different people, it's not at all going to be a chore, and it's not going to be something that you have to really fight to stay awake during, or... Even when it's very complicated, it's not necessarily going to be difficult to, you know, follow and parse and discuss with other people.
And for me, cartoons. Like, I watch cartoons because I know that I don't have to invest myself in the plot. I know that if I miss an episode, it's totally fine because the scenes are, like, 10 seconds long anyway.
Are you talking about the things that Kelsey was talking
yeah.
about, cartoons?
Yeah.
Like Simpsons.
Like
and
Archer,
South Park.
Simpsons. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I find myself pretending to be into that stuff with him. Totally not. There.
Yeah, it's totally like an instant gratification thing.
Well, speaking of instant gratification / Twinkies, we're going to talk about summer movies. And first I'm going to read a quote from the New York Times Summer Movie Preview Edition by Douglas McGrath. Sorry. For people over a certain age, 16, the phrase summer movie summons a mouth-drying dread, a degree of despair that is only exceeded by the phrase summer movie season, an endless desert of the bloated and the moronic. Now, summer movie season is its own thing, right? What do you think? Do you feel a dread going? We're starting summer movie season basically this month. I mean, May is kind of the kickoff. Are you dreading the onslaught of blockbusters, or are you, like me, actually really looking forward to them and kind of can't wait?
Well, I don't know if I should start off this conversation because I also work at a movie theater that will be showing Pirates of the Caribbean in 3D, Harry Potter in 3D, and Something Borrowed for 2 weeks.
So you've got a different, but it's good we have you here because you have an inside.
Yeah,
look.
As far as summer movies.
Plus your financial investment is
yeah.
like slightly.
Longer hours.
Yeah.
I sort of see it as like this whole, like a meta thing about how the movie industry works now, where I just see like a bunch of sequels coming out, churned out, and I'm not excited about it. It's not something that, the movies that my theater does not play, I don't like paying $10 to go see them in a theater. and prefer seeing them later when they're, I don't have to spend as much money. Again, sorry about accessibility and time and money.
It's important though.
No, that's totally a factor.
Yeah. Yeah. So I, and again, with investment, I'm like, sometimes I just chalk it up, say like, I didn't see this first X-Men movie, so therefore I can't see the second one, which I know doesn't actually make any sense. So I'm not thrilled about it. But
for me, it's more of a holistic thing. Like every summer there's something that I get excited about, and it might be a sequel. Like for instance, this summer I'm really excited about the X-Men Origins, X-Men First Class, which tells like the origin story of Professor X and Magneto. I'm super excited about that. But summer movies as a whole tends to be when you kind of see the worst traits of Hollywood, you know, sort of bloated wastefulness, huge budgets, the kind of shunting of women and girl characters into the kind of Smurfette role where they're like,
just kind of literally, because there's a Smurfs movie.
Oh yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, you know, where there's sort of one woman among sort of the big action dudes, whether it's in Transformers or Pirates of the Caribbean or what have you. So I think it's more the, to me, it's sort of more the cumulative history of summer movie season and what it usually means for sort of progressive narratives and representations. So in that sense, I dread it.
I have to say, I agree with what both of you are saying, and I accept it as true, yet somehow, and I think this is just, I'm a product of the Hollywood season, I am looking forward to movies that are coming out this summer that, were they to be released in the wintertime, I would not see. And I don't, I'm interested just for myself as to what it is. Is it just because I...
Because you don't have air conditioning.
It's because I was going to say, I think it might be partially because I don't have air conditioning. And so I'm probably going to see Thor in the theater in 3D, partially so that I can sit in air conditioning for 2 hours, but also partially because there's something about the spectacle that seems summery to me, like 4th of July and fireworks and action movies, and I get psyched about it. And I'm not an action movie person. It's not, that's not really what I normally gravitate toward, but this summer I am. And we looked at some different summer movie previews, and so I don't know if, maybe if we want to go around and just say something that we are really looking forward to seeing for real. I think maybe there are some things that that are coming up. But I, again, with the summer movie season, I have to admit, I found myself going through a slideshow of 38 movies that are coming out this summer and making a list of which ones I was excited to see. And I had to stop myself when I got past like 15 out of, I mean, it was just like, ooh, I definitely want to see this. I'm totally going to go to this. I don't know. Maybe it is air conditioning. I really do hate to be hot in the house.
I went through that list too, and I was just sort of, I just felt that so many of them were the same movie that there was literally The Hangover 2, but it seemed that so many of them were trying to like ape The Hangover franchise anyway with like a bunch of dudes, buddy films that just keep being churned out. But what I guess what I am looking forward to seeing is Super 8, which is Steven Spielberg and J.J. Abrams, and it's about, well, I don't know most of the plot, but it's about, it looks pretty, and it looks a little bit smarter than your average movie, and so I'm looking forward to that.
Oh, that was mine. I'm really excited about Super 8, and stars Kyle Chandler, Coach Eric Taylor from Friday Night Lights.
well, like I said, I'm really looking forward to seeing X-Men First Class. You know, I always look with a specific eye toward, you know, again, like where women are in the narrative and sort of the positioning. And there are very few films coming out this summer. And certainly, I don't think any of the blockbusters have a female character at the center, unless it is like a romantic comedy, like Something Borrowed, or maybe the one with... Cameron Diaz, Bad Teacher. But that also does appear to be an ensemble comedy. Like Justin Timberlake is very prominent. Jason Segel is very prominent. So oddly, I'm looking forward to seeing Our Idiot Brother, which is, I think it's sort of indie. It seems to be like one of those Apatovian comedies with like one of, like,
it looks a
Elizabeth
little more,
Banks is in it. Yeah. Paul Rudd's in it. Rashida Jones is in it. All of those people are great. But to me, it also seems like the only one where the male characters are outnumbered by the female co-stars, and there seems to be potential for, you know, interactions that have more to do with, like, family and sort of relational, you know, hijinks than with either romance or like the woman sort of running after the action hero guys being like, I can shoot a gun too.
Instead it's like, man, our brother, he's a real loser.
Yeah. But in a funny way.
No, in a funny way. I have to say, I wrote down my top three, and the first two were Our Idiot Brother and Super 8, so I think we're going to have to probably
field trip.
Review those at some point. And then my third summer movie that I'm looking forward to is Everything Must Go, which is, it stars Will Ferrell. It's, I mean, the summer is a dude fest times a million. I mean, except for Bridesmaids, which we already reviewed. It seems like we're lacking in women main characters quite a bit, but Everything Must Go is about Will Ferrell, who he gets fired from his job and his wife leaves him. And it looks like, it sounds kind of cheesy to describe the plot as just like, then he has to sell all of his stuff in a big yard sale. But the trailer really was compelling to me. I felt really drawn in by what I'm assuming the narrative is. And also I love yard sales. So, and that's a big part of the summer, buying stuff at garage sales. And I'm really excited to see Christopher C.J. Wallace, the child star, or he's probably a tween, of the movie. He is Notorious B.I.G.'s son. And if you saw the movie Notorious.
Right, he was in it.
He played the young Christopher Wallace in Notorious. And I just found him so charismatic. I'm really excited that he's having a career beyond just playing in a biopic about his dad. I think he seems like a great actor. And in the trailer, I was just already touched by him. I was telling Andy and Tristan, I was literally tearing up during the trailer. So we'll see if the movie is as heartfelt as the trailer appears to be, but I'm looking forward to it. Along with 37 others for movies. But, you know, there obviously there's some clunkers out there too. But, you know, air conditioning. Okay, well, I think that does it for our discussion today. Why don't we wrap it up with our bitch faves? Tristan, do you have a fave to share with us?
Sure. Well, speaking of Netflix Instant, I began watching My So-Called Life, which I never watched growing up because my parents didn't let me watch shows like that. But I've really been enjoying it, and the fact that I think it's really great now, and I think speaks to that it was a really good show, and I feel like I can watch it because there's only one season, and anyways, I've been enjoying it, so.
I'm reading three different books about music, all of which are sort of awesome, and all of which kind of inform one another. One is called Hot Stuff, and it's by Alice Eccles, and it's sort of about the cultural history of disco, and the sort of progressive political legacy of disco. The second one is a biography of Queen, which I'm really excited about because I love Queen, and I'm already psyching myself up for the 2012 biopic about Freddie Mercury starring Sacha Baron Cohen, which I'm going to try and manage my expectations because it could just be like Borat as Freddie Mercury, and that would be a travesty. And the third book is a book that we have a review of in the upcoming issue of Bitch, and we've reviewed on the website, which is Out of the Vinyl Deeps, and it's the collected music criticism of Ellen Willis.
All right, and we had a blog post about that this week,
too. Yes, we did.
Well, I am excited this week about a Beyoncé video for the Let's Move presidential fitness campaign, and the video is... I think they're calling it like a flash workout, but anyway, Beyonce has an instructional video that teaches you how to do a dance to this song called Let's Move that is a Swizz Beatz remix of her song Get Me Bodied, if you're a Beyonce fan. And so the dance looks pretty easy to learn. And the thing that's most exciting to me is that already there are all these videos up of these just like awesome dancers in middle schools across the country doing this routine. Video of Michelle Obama doing it. She does the Running Man. It's just like, I feel like Michelle Obama has managed to make the presidential fitness campaign really cool and fun. And that's exciting to me. I am happy for all those kids in middle school who get to do a Beyonce dance routine instead of do like the arm chin hang thing off the bar that I had to do
that
for
was the worst.
Presidential yeah. fitness. And there's this really great video that I will post a link to that where it's a group of middle school kids who are doing the dance, practicing it, and then surprise, Beyonce comes into the gym and does the dance with them, and it's just like feel good moment of the year. So I'll post a link, check it out. And I for one want to learn the dance. I'm not.
I want Beyonce to walk into the office surprise right now.
Yeah. If we do the dance, maybe we can summon her. It's like Candyman or something.
Yes. We do it three times fast.
Yeah. We're going to start now. All right. Well, thanks so much for tuning into this episode of Popaganda, and be sure to visit bitchmagazine.org/audio for even more.
Thanks for tuning in. Bitch Media is a nonprofit organization, and we rely on the support of listeners like you. Visit bitchmedia.org/donate to find out how you can support what you love. What we'd love is to hear what you think. Email radio@bwar.org with your feedback.